On 88.1 WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Last night, Hillary Clinton won 4 out of 6 primaries, including the coveted prize of California, making history as the first woman to lead a major party ticket. Bernie Sanders told his supporters that the struggle continues, even as he told half of his staff that they'll need to find another job. I'm joined this morning by John Fritzy, the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, to talk about how a Maryland congressman will help bring the Sanders and Clinton camps together to fight Donald Trump. Plus, Jane Brown and Ruby Lerner are highly respected philanthropists whose giving is focused on the arts, on the premise that artists bring creative capital to communities that can transform people and places in a unique way. We'll talk about how the arts are making a difference in Baltimore and beyond. Benjamin Warner tells us about his debut novel, Thirst, and Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. We'll start with the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. We'll start this morning with presidential politics. Yesterday was the final day of multiple Democratic primaries in this political season that has been unusual, to say the least, since it began with the Iowa caucuses back on the 1st of February. The District of Columbia will hold its primary next Tuesday, but as of last night, Hillary Clinton joins Donald Trump as a presumptive nominee, having amassed more than enough delegates to secure the nomination when the Democrats convene for their convention in Philadelphia next month. Bernie Sanders was hoping for an upset win in California to create momentum and bolster his case to superdelegates that he, rather than Secretary Clinton, is best equipped to beat Donald Trump in November. But although recent polls showed the race in California to be close, it appears that Secretary Clinton will win there by a significant margin. Secretary Clinton reached her magic number on Monday night, the night before the primaries. The Associated Press and other news organizations surveyed superdelegates who had not yet made a public commitment to any candidate and determined that with her pledged delegates and superdelegates, Secretary Clinton had surpassed the magic number of 2383. John Fritzy is the national reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He joins me on the phone from Washington. Morning, John. How you doing?
Hi, Tom. Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. So your reactions to Secretary Clinton's speech last night, which she gave before the polls in California had even closed?
Well, I think a lot of last night was about symbolism. Obviously, you can't overstate the significance of the first woman ever to lock up a nomination for either major party. That's a pretty significant and important thing, but it also wasn't a surprise, right? We've known for weeks, if not months, pretty much since the April primary in New York, that Clinton was going to lock this thing down. And so for me, looking at last night's speech, I think a lot of what she's trying to do is pivot once again to the general election. And the more she has the sort of celebratory images that she had last night, the more we have President Obama, who last night issued a congratulations to her by a statement. I suspect he'll do it on a stage pretty soon. The more you see that kind of thing, the easier it is for her to transition to the general election.
She certainly did not in any way shy away from the historic nature of what happened last night, her being the first woman to head a major party ticket. That's a vast difference from her approach back in 2008. And this entire campaign is so remarkably different on the Democratic side and the Republican side, for that matter. But the Democrats are approaching this race in a very different way than they did when then-Senator Obama was running against Senator Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a, you know, obviously both elections were a big deal. Both were historic, right? And I think, you know, I think a lot of Democrats feel like, you know, that based on what happened in 2008, that it was sort of the right time for Clinton. And so I think there's a fair number of Democrats, certainly in the party establishment, that feel that way. And you know, it is. It's a big deal. It's definitely worth taking a moment to pause, no matter your politics, to sort of note that history. And I think that's part of what she was trying to do last night.
You wrote a piece a couple days ago about Elijah Cummings, the congressman from Maryland, who will be very much in the mix when it comes to deciding the Democratic Party platform for the convention in Philadelphia. Senator Sanders last night vowing to fight on. He is laying off half of his staff. He referenced in his remarks that he had amassed about 10 million votes. I guess Secretary Clinton is somewhere around 15 million. And Sanders had won 22 states, I believe, once the dust has settled. Again, not as many as Mrs. Clinton, who's in the mid-30s. But what do you think Elijah Cummings' challenge is in terms of bringing the Sanders camp into a unified force with the Clinton campaign?
Right. I mean, a couple of thoughts on that. One thing that I think is important to remember is that Hillary Clinton in 2008, losing to Barack Obama, was in a much stronger position at that time than Bernie Sanders is losing to Hillary Clinton this time. She had a higher share of the popular vote. She had way more delegates and way more superdelegates. And so, you know, Sanders is just not in as strong of a position based on the math. What he has, of course, is this very energetic, youthful constituency that has brought a lot of energy to the party, some of the same people that propelled Barack Obama in 2008. And so, you know, he does have some leverage here, and, you know, how he uses that is remains to be seen. I think one of the areas where he will try to exert influence, and one of the reasons why he's talking about staying in, is in order to exert influence on the platform. And so I think, you know, he will look for things like making sure that Clinton, who has kind of come around on free trade agreements, on opposing those, that she sticks to it, you know, and that makes its way into the platform. I think things like Wall Street regulation, certainly, which has been a centerpiece of Sanders' campaign, you know, he will want to ensure that the party's platform, the official platform document, includes some stronger language than maybe Clinton would like to see. And so I think, you know, Elijah Cummings, Congressman Cummings from Baltimore, certainly has a role to play in that. In fact, that process begins today in Washington. There'll be a hearing where people can come in and testify about what they'd like to see the platform look like. And those there'll be a series of hearings over the next couple of weeks as they draft that document. So I think platform is one. The other one real quick is just to note, you know, rules might be another one. So another place that Sanders may look to influence the process is maybe a less important role for superdelegates, for instance. So I think, you know, there are areas where he will try to influence things. And I think right now this talk of staying in and fighting on, what that's really about is negotiating influence at the conventions this summer.
So you think platform and rules will be the central way, the sort of fundamental method by which the party becomes united, or is it going to be just part of a complex of things that will also take place that show people that this is, in fact, a united front at some point?
You're right. I think it's a bunch of things. I think platform is certainly one of those things, although it's worth remembering that the platform is not binding on anyone, right? And so it's sort of a symbolic document. You know, what it really comes down to is, will these Bernie Sanders turn out for Clinton? And I think a lot of that depends on what Clinton does. Does she say things or sound the right notes? Who does she pick for a vice presidential candidate? When we start talking about cabinet picks, who does she select or talk about selecting? You know, those are the things that progressives in the party are going to be, you know, really clued into and paying attention to when they make a decision about how they feel about her.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall, joined on the phone by John Fritzy. He's the national correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. We're talking a little presidential politics this morning. John, what is the effect now of the Trump candidacy going to be down ballot here in Maryland? For example, Kathy Shalega, the Republican candidate for the Senate seat being vacated by current Senator Barbara Mikulski. She's running against Congressman Chris Van Hollen. She endorsed Rick Perry early on in the Republican race. Is Trump a ball and chain to her? She has disavowed the remarks that he made about the judge and the Trump University case. But she's one of several senators facing tough election fights that appear to really be hindered by their link to Trump and the Republican Party.
It's totally fascinating. I mean, if you watched that Trump speech last night, he was on a teleprompter. He was very composed. you know, somewhat presidential. I mean, it was the kind of speech that establishment Republicans wanted to see, people like Speaker Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And the reason why he delivered that speech the way he did at the time he did is because back on Capitol Hill, Republicans are sort of in disarray over these comments, over the judge that's overseeing his case on Trump University. And so you've got candidates for office, Republican candidates, that are being pressed relentlessly by reporters. Well, you know, he's your party standard bearer. Do you accept that line of argument that Trump has been making? You saw yesterday Mark Kirk, who's the Illinois senator, a Republican in a blue-leaning state, disavowing Trump and withdrawing his support for him. And I think there's the possibility you'll see more of that if there's more sort of off-scripted messages like the one Trump stepped into this week. Shalega, you know, she's an interesting case. She has said she will support the Republican nominee. She did, as you know, disavow those comments. I reached out to them yesterday to see if Mark Kirk's decision to pull out has affected her. It doesn't appear that it has. I didn't get any response back that she's not going to endorse him. I think a lot of Republicans in Shalega's position are probably going to wait and see a little bit. You know, after last night, I think there's a couple of questions watching that speech. One is, can Trump maintain that composure? Two is it too late, right? In other words, if the last several months rendered that composure ineffective? And three is that really what his supporters want to see? I mean, he's been very successful in these primaries by speaking off the cuff and saying some of these things. If he had been a candidate who went through the primaries with that kind of speech, I think there's a real question about whether he would have won the nomination or not.
And it's interesting to see if people will just assume that he, in fact, can flip a switch and all of a sudden become this different person all of a sudden, having been the person that he has quite publicly been for the last year, perhaps the last 30 years. So it is a fascinating race in so many different ways. We appreciate your staying on top of it for us, and we will talk to you again soon as the political season continues. John Fritzy, thanks so much, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Fritzy is the national reporter for the Baltimore Sun. We've got a link to his reporting on politics at our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Stay tuned to WIPR and NPR for complete coverage of the presidential race as it moves to the next stage. The Republican convention takes place in Cleveland on July 18th. The Democrats will gather in Philadelphia the following week. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, investing in artists to transform communities. Stay with us. Nathan, back to you.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Now, a conversation about the impact that the arts and artists can have in communities across the country. My guests are two philanthropists who have approached the endeavor of philanthropy in a particularly thoughtful and systematic way. Ruby Lerner is the founding president and executive director of Creative Capital in New York. Since 1999, Creative Capital has supported projects by more than 640 artists in communities across the United States. Jane Brown is the president and executive director of the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation, based here in Baltimore. The foundation focuses on innovation in the arts, as well as science and technology, education, and social justice. One of their most recent projects is the Motor House in Station North Arts and Entertainment District. In addition to office space for several arts organizations, it's a performance space, incubator, and gallery. The Deutsch Foundation also supports the Rubies, competitive grants program for local artists. Ruby Lerner, after whom the Rubies are named, and Jane Brown both join me in the studio. Good morning to you both. It's good to see you.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Jane Brown, speaking of the Rubies were announced. You've awarded nine grants to artists, and they do what sort of work? Give us the sort of the range of the kind of platforms they work in.
Well, every year we're doing two rounds of Rubies. This round that was just announced are media artists, artists working in film and video, and performing artists. We had a particularly strong group of media artists this time. Very exciting projects. We can't wait. The way that the Rubies work, artists get up to $10,000 for their projects. Some of them ask for less, but they can get up to $10,000. And then within a year of the award, there is some kind of public performance or some kind of, we're
exhibition
able to.
Exhibition or event or something.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then in subsequent years, then you change the platforms. You change the media that artists are working in. So this year it's media.
Well, we do two rounds a year. Mm-hmm. So this first one is media arts and performance arts. And then the second one this year will be literary arts and visual arts.
Yeah.
And those categories, we've learned all of this. The Rubies are modeled on the Creative Capital Awards. And so I think this is the same way that Creative Capital does.
So Ruby Learner, let's talk about that. Creative Capital premise seems to be modeled on venture capitalism, the way people invest in companies. You're investing in artists.
Yes, this was kind of a brand new idea in the late 90s. There had been a shift in philanthropic thinking by people who had made money in what you would call new economy businesses. And they looked at traditional philanthropy, what I call the sort of here's a check, send us a report model of philanthropy. And they thought, well, we didn't build our successful businesses that way. We had much more engagement from the people who were supporting us. So maybe there's a different way to think about helping, particularly social service kinds of nonprofits, so housing and education, for instance, healthcare. So they created a whole subset of philanthropy called social venture philanthropy, or sometimes called high engagement grant making. So I was hired to kind of take that idea, both venture capital and venture philanthropy, and see if it could be imported into the cultural arena in support of individual artists. People thought we were crazy, that artists would hate it, that it was too interventionist, that we wouldn't get any applications. When we got 1,800 applications in our very first year, that kind of quieted everyone down. But in fact, this higher level of engagement approach is actually welcomed by artists. And so much so that many of our grantees, when they finish the process with us, often will say, this grant was not about the money. It was about all the other things that I was able to take advantage of during the period of the grant.
And those other things include career development, professional development.
Yes, a lot of career development. So we help people think of themselves as small businesses. We think that you are a business of one, or if you're working in a collaborative way, you're still a small business. And that in order to thrive, there's a whole skill set that you actually need to cultivate. And it doesn't mean that you're going to become a master fundraiser or a genius at writing your own press releases, but that you're going to know enough to kind of be the person who's in charge of your career and to be able to direct people who might partner with you.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. That's Ruby Learner. She's the founding president and executive director of Creative Capital in New York. Jane Brown is here as well. She's the president and executive director of the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation here in Baltimore. In full disclosure, the foundation and Jane, you and your husband, Neil, and your personal giving have been supportive of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society, and we are delighted and grateful for that. But we're not here to talk about the Choral Arts Society this morning. What we are going to talk about is this notion that both of you share, that there is a capacity of artists to change paradigms in communities. It's not just about making pretty things. It's about moving the needle. What are you hoping that, your Ruby grantees and the other folks that you're supporting are going to be able to do to move the needle?
Mm. Well, so far, I think we're approaching 50 artists in only the 3.5 years that the program has been in existence. And the degree of social awareness and commitment to the community is just, it's so gratifying to us. We don't really, and I think part of the panels that we engage to judge all the people who are applying for these awards, we've made it very clear that we care about the social practice and about the engagement with community. And it's just been so amazing to see these artists and their deep commitment, especially to a community that in Baltimore right now that is so challenged. And really, we learned, I had never, the foundation had never invested in the arts at all. We were investing in science and technology until we met Ruby and learned and saw what Creative Capital was doing and really saw that artists really can have this huge impact on the world in so many different and creative ways. And I really began to see that artists are kind of the research and development arm of, you know, they play this very unique role. And here in Baltimore, we're really starting to see, I mean, it's not just the Rubies, but in so many ways, artists having a profound impact. After the after Freddie Gray's death and the uprising here, it was really members of the arts community that were out there engaging the community, helping it to begin to heal right away.
Yeah.
I was so gratified by that.
Yeah, and Ruby Lerner, what is the particular capacity, you think, of artists to do things? What can they do that business people or scientists or others can't?
We had a very interesting event just a few weeks ago in New York, it was we called it a creative conversation, and it was about criminal justice system and mass incarceration. And we had five artists presenting their projects, and then we had time for comments and questions from the audience. And the president of the ACLU in New York was there, and she stood up and said, "We need you," to the artists, she said this, "we need you around the country where these conversations are happening because you bring a humanity to this conversation that is often missing. You know, if you're talking about legislation or position papers, it's not the same as a group of people talking about human beings as community institutions." And so it changes it humanizes discourse, I think, and personalizes discourse in a way that's just missing if artists aren't there. But I also think that artists have training to actually come at problems just from a very different perspective. Mm-hmm. And we have an amazing artist that we've funded who is looking at what she calls our death denial cult in this country. And she is going to maybe single-handedly revolutionize the funeral industry, which is a really toxic industry. And she's actually created a business now out of her Creative Capital project. And when you see that the thinking that she brought to the process, you know that the art training process can just unleash a new way of seeing.
Yeah. And Jane, it's interesting to me that you and Ruby both concentrate on individuals in a lot of ways rather than institutions. Davon Love, who's a black community organizer, activist here, is with a group called Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, refers to the nonprofit industrial complex, these institutions that, well-meaning as they may be, often don't have the sort of flexibility and the wherewithal to do things in a real sort of on-the-ground way. But you've recognized that for quite a few years now.
Yeah. Well, investing in individuals is absolutely critical. Baltimore is a place, when we began to invest in the arts, we didn't see anybody else who was willing to really invest in very risky small organizations as well as individuals. And again, we've learned so much from Creative Capital that investing in individuals and really helping them understand their career trajectory and how they're going to sustain themselves really pays off in significant ways. And we're really seeing that. Some of the Ruby's artists who are also Creative Capital grantees, they've been amazing in the way that they're mentoring younger artists in the Baltimore community. So there's just...
Yeah, so it sustains and continues generationally. Yeah,
it really
and
multiplies.
Is it a matter, Ruby Lerner, of institutions just sort of being, you know, gigantic cruise lines that you can't turn on a dime very easily? I mean, individuals just have more, a better opportunity to make stuff happen quicker.
I think that's right. It's very difficult. The more institutional you become, the more risk-averse you become. And I think that I don't like to think that that's a natural process of maturing, but it's something you really have to, I think, guard against. And at every step of the way, I think about this a lot with Creative Capital. We're in our 18th year now, and you know, we're getting to that next phase of development. We're not a startup anymore. One of our original original board member says, we always have to be an upstart, even though we might not be a startup. And I hope that that attitude can persist, because there's nothing more important, really, than risk. And if you get to a place where you get terrified of risk because you might offend this person over here or that funder over there, then what I would say is you don't have the right funders for what you're doing.
But risk aversion works both ways. I mean, you've had to take some chances, I would imagine, out of 640-something projects, that some of them blow up, some of them are robust.
That is correct. And, you know, one of the things I do with a lot of the people, you know, who are sort of new to us, and they come and they get very excited, and I do what I call the New York Times test with them. And the New York Times test is, so one of our artists lands on the front page of the New York Times, and it's not with a great review of their work. How are you going to feel? And I've turned money down, actually, if people don't have a good answer to that question.
Yeah. How do you measure, Jane Brown? How do you measure when you're deciding philanthropic allocations? How are you deciding what's good, what's bad?
You know, it's very hard to be scientific. I mean, we made a decision many years ago to take risk. A lot of what we fund, we're not talking about the rubies now, that's all decided by very qualified people on panels that are specific to each of those.
Peer review, right.
Peer review. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But the rest of our arts funding is, I mean, we spend a lot of time being very proximate. We're very deeply engaged on the ground and talk to an awful lot of people who are deeply engaged, and we work closely with people from whom we can understand what impact is. There's really no single metric where you can say, you know, how can I measure this?
A lot of it's just experiential and empirical. I mean, you know the artists you can trust, and you see what work they've done in the past.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, great. Well, it's terrific to talk to both of you. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ruby Lerner is the founding president and executive director of Creative Capital in New York. Jane Brown is the president and executive director of the Robert W. Deutsch Foundation in Baltimore. We've got a link to the Creative Capital and Deutsch Foundation websites at our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Marilyn Morning. Lots more coming up. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan, and welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's Marilyn Morning. My next guest is Benjamin Warner. He teaches creative writing at Towson University, and he has just published his debut novel, Thirst. It's a suspenseful, apocalyptic tale of what happens when the water supply is cut off and how people respond to this life-threatening disaster. Ben, it's nice to meet you. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So this is quite the tale. I got to say that as I read it, it made me squirm a little bit, the notion that you can't get water, and that's what happens to the two main characters and a host of other folks. Tell us a little bit about Eddie Chapman and his wife, Laura.
So Eddie Chapman and his wife are, I've been tinkering with characters like them since I was an undergrad, really, writing stories in creative writing classes. They're part of what I think of as sort of a privileged class. They're white, middle-class, employed. They step out of their door in the morning and they just sort of succeed by walking through life. And I've been fascinated by people like them because they seem so, at least these two characters, seem so unprepared for the world to change around them, particularly a crisis like this where, you know, it's impossible with all the water around them disappears.
It's interesting that I live near Reservoir Hill, in Reservoir Hill, near Druid Park. And there's a reservoir mm-hmm. in Druid Park, and there are plans to dramatically change it. And it has to do with security of the water supply. The Homeland Security is concerned that the reservoir, the water there could be subject to a terrorist attack. So this is something that people are thinking about. Were you thinking about it as well in those terms? And did you research it as a possible terrorist act? Because it doesn't seem to be clear in the book what the reason is that the water is gone.
Yeah, the reason was not nearly as important to me as the relationship between these two characters. But yeah, that kind of thing is in the back of my head. I canoed down the Mississippi River in 2001. I heard about 9/11 on the boat on a little radio, a little AM/FM radio that we had on the bow of the boat. And we had been taking our canoe through the lock and dam systems on the Mississippi River. And then after 9/11, suddenly we had trouble doing that. I mean, we should have had trouble probably from the get-go, but we didn't. And it was because of the threat of terrorism. And so suddenly that seemed very real and very terrifying that we have this unprotected water supply.
Thirst is the new novel by Benjamin Warner. He joins me here in the studio. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It seems to me that as a writer, you have a unique challenge in writing this kind of apocalyptic tale, and that is keeping the reader's interest when everything goes wrong. You know, everything goes bad. It's just one unfortunate incident after another. Mm-hmm. Because there's a basic human need for optimism or a human, you know, yearning for some good news. But you're writing a book that starts with bad news from the very first page, and the news doesn't get much better by the end. How do you approach that as a writer?
Well, in some sense, for me, it's a cheat. I teach creative writing at Towson, and one of the things I tell my students is that storytelling is conflict. And this is a novel, as you say, that starts with one problem, which leads to the next, which leads to the next. And it's almost ceaseless. So in one way, I'm almost using it as a crutch, as a storyteller, to keep the story going forward. But I think it's very important for writers to kind of exist in the area of disappointment and anxiety. I think that's what makes, for me anyway, really nice storytelling.
Some folks have compared this book quite favorably to The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which I guess was a very famous movie, too. I didn't see the movie. I read the book. Did you, in fact, learn anything in particular from that novel? That's another apocalyptic sort of post-nuclear thing, right?
And I had read that book. I'd actually taught that book before I wrote my novel, and it certainly existed in my imagination. I could dig around and probably tell you what I learned from that work, but I don't know off the top of my head. I know that I really enjoyed that book and that it haunted me, that it still haunts me. It's a really terrifying and beautiful read.
Is the apocalyptic novel in general something that you're interested in? Have you read others? Because there's certainly a whole slew of others.
I've only started reading others after my book was sold, because people were reading it and saying, you should read this book. It's very much like, you know, book X. And so I read Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. My wife, as soon as she read the first draft of Thirst, said, this reminds me a lot of Jose Saramago's novel Blindness. And so after I'd written the book, I read Blindness, which is another really beautiful and haunting novel.
Well, it's a good deal to have a first novel and have it compared to Cormac McCarthy and Saramago. That's pretty good.
That is pretty good. I mean, of course, it's my wife doing that.
Yeah, so that's right. Take it with a grain of salt. Right? It's interesting to me that as things get worse, with the two main characters and some others, there are some secrets that get revealed as, you know, sort of death approaches. Is that, in fact, do you think, a natural human instinct? In other words, if people sense the end is near, they want to bear all before they go? Or would it be more of a natural instinct to say, oh, thank God, at least I'm going to die, but at least no one ever found me out when I did this terrible thing, X or Y?
Yeah, there are some almost deathbed confession moments in this book. I don't know if that's human tendency or not, but I mentioned that I had toyed with these characters before in different iterations with different names, different ages, and always one of them had a deeply held secret. And one of the problems I had in writing this as a short story, not this exact version, but was to get the character to reveal that secret. If life is good, there seemed to me no reason for one character to tell the other character what had happened in her distant past before she had met him. So placing them in this scenario, this crisis where all the water was gone, it did accelerate the need to reveal herself.
You also edit a literary magazine for homeless people. It's called Voices and Visions. I haven't seen it, but tell us about that.
So I don't do that anymore. I did that when I was volunteering at a homeless assistance center in Silver Spring, Maryland. So Montgomery County, one of the richest counties in America, and they have this terrible problem with homelessness where people are really suffering. And so I was looking for a way to volunteer at this center, and I was working at the front desk answering phones, which was fine, but it didn't seem like a great fit. And I asked the woman who headed up their programs what I could do with my particular skill set. And she said, well, why don't you teach a poetry class? And people started coming. I had three or four regulars, and they really wanted to publish their work. So I started putting out a little magazine with the poetry of the homeless from Silver Spring. And we did that for maybe 3 years.
And how'd you distribute it?
By hand, in coffee shops, word of mouth. It was very low budget, mm-hmm. and there weren't many copies.
But it just shows that, you know, folks, that regardless of their circumstances, you know, there's a desire to tell your story. There's a desire to...
An intense desire.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a very interesting story that you've written in this first novel, Thirst, and I really very much appreciate your coming by and talking about it.
Thanks for having me.
Benjamin Warren. He is on the faculty of Towson University. His debut novel is called Thirst. He'll be talking about it tomorrow night at the Dundalk Dialogues Author Series at the North Point Branch of the Baltimore County Library on Merritt Boulevard over in Dundalk. That event starts at 7 o'clock. We've got a link to details when you come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday, the next installment in our series, The Accountability Index. We'll also talk about how the art of polling is changing in this poll-heavy political season. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has her review of Ryan O'Neill and Ally McGraw in Love Letters at the Hippodrome. And we'll check out the latest album from one of my favorite bands, Boyster. Hope you join us Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. The Writer's Almanac is up next. Have a great day.